I next met with Dr. Norman Walmark, chairperson of the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project. And to begin, he commented on a study presented at last year's ASCO meeting in which the Oncotype DX colon assay was applied retrospectively to NSABP-C07, a trial evaluating the addition of oxaliplatin to 5-FU in the adjuvant setting.
I think that was a significant presentation as far as moving the state of the art forward. I think if there was any hesitation or concern relative to the value of the 12-gene Oncotype assay for colon cancer, specifically the recurrence score, that I think the data from C07, I think resoundingly confirm the ability of the 12-gene assay to predict outcome. So it doesn't predict the response to chemotherapy, but certainly is associated with outcome and is independent of other discriminants such as nodal status, tumor grade, so-called lymphovascular invasion. And I think it really provides very strong confirmatory evidence that this algorithm is a definitive algorithm in being able to determine the likelihood of recurrence. So to give you a brief history of how the assay came about, that as you know, in December of 2003, we first reported the data associated with breast, where the Oncotype DX showed that 50% of node-negative ER-positive patients were associated with an extremely good outcome, and we subsequently showed that it was only the one-third with a high risk that sustained almost the entire benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. And at that time, namely around 2004, we wanted to develop an Oncotype assay that would be associated with recurrence in colon cancer in the adjuvant setting. And we also were hopeful that we could develop a treatment score as well to determine or to predict the efficacy of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. We were successful, I think, in the former. And I think we're making progress relative to the latter. So in 2004, the feasibility studies started to be conducted, and out of 761 candidate genes, 48 were eventually chosen for their association with outcome in univariate analysis. And that this came out of some older NSABP trials, C01, C02, which had untreated controls, and you know that's what really started the process. Also, we had a cohort of 765 patients from the Cleveland Clinic that had untreated controls. And then we used data from NSABP-C04, where they were all treated with 5-FU-based regimens, and C06, which compared FU leucovorin to UFT, for a total of 1,851 patients, which constituted the developmental phase, and then came up with the 12-gene algorithm. And using cluster and principal component analysis, the genes that were strongly associated with outcome were put into categories. We had 3 genes in the stromal group and 3 genes in the proliferative or cell cycle group, including Ki67. And then 1 gene without portfolio, GAD45B, which is associated with stress. And then 5 reference genes, just as we had in breast cancer, of course not the same genes, to normalize the data. Then each group was assigned a score, developing the recurrence score algorithm. The next step was to validate this and to validate it prospectively. So this algorithm was taken in its nascent form, unaltered, and applied to the data from the QUASAR study, which, as you know, is a study which utilized predominantly stage 2 patients, and they were randomized to no treatment or 5-FU-based combination regimens, excluding, of course, oxaliplatin. And from the prospective validation of that in the surgery-only cohort, for whom there were 600 or over 600 successfully completed assays, there was a very definitive continuous variable just as there was in breast cancer, ranging from about 9% to 28% as far as recurrence score associated with risk of recurrence at 3 years. So I think this showed quite definitively that not all stage twos are the same, and that there's a spectrum that can be defined as low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk. Of course, the risk categories are arbitrary, since the real essence of the assay is the continuous variable, just as it is in breast cancer. And 40% of the stage two cohort fell into the so-called good risk category, which is anything under a 15% recurrence at 3 years. The intermediate group has an average of about 18% recurrence, ranging from 15 to 18. And the high risk, which constitutes about 25% of the cohort, ranges from 18 to 28%. So we have different risks of recurrence in this untreated stage two population. What is interesting is that the high-risk group falls into a category that overlaps with a favorable 1 to 3 positive node groups. So it's a continuous spectrum. And what we also noted was that the genetic makeup of stage 2 and stage 3 disease was almost identical. So it takes us back to the paper that we published in 1999, making the argument that the relative risk of benefit for stage twos and stage threes with chemotherapy that has an incremental gain is no different.
And it's kind of interesting. In doing CME, of course, we're dealing with all different kinds of investigators, and particularly I notice in colon cancer, but also in lung cancer, they don't really have that same kind of paradigm when they think about adjuvant therapy as in breast, what you're saying that, you know, it's biologically the same disease. And I know there's been a lot of controversy in colon cancer, and it seems like the NSABP has been on one side of the fence and a bunch of other people on the other side.
Well, I think having an objective genetic algorithm, I think, goes a long way to add objectivity to arguments that we have been engaged in for the last 30 years, you know, the treatment of stage twos and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's really weird. I was just doing this case thing on lung cancer, and they had a tumor that was 3.9 centimeters, and their big trial, it had to be 4 centimeters, and that was it. You know, they're not thinking about adjuvant therapy because it doesn't hit that bar. It kind of like reminds me of the way we thought about breast cancer around maybe the late 90s.
So I think that if there is a breath of fresh air on the horizon relative to adjuvant therapy, which, as you know, has been in the doldrums for a good while now, with studies that have been notable for the lack of success rather than their success, bevacizumab, cetuximab, irinotecan, that I think this can be looked upon as a step forward in understanding the biology of the disease, but also being able to use this algorithm in the decision-making process of whether to treat or not to treat, or for that matter, based on the C07 data, whether to utilize oxaliplatin or not utilize oxaliplatin.
And, you know, I found that really fascinating. But, you know, one thing I want to ask you about the QUASAR study that you were just talking about, as you mentioned, it was able to divide these patients into risk categories. But a lot of people came away from that presentation and then the publication saying, well, yeah, it's prognostic, but it's, quote, not predictive. And although, you know, they didn't see a different relative risk reduction in the groups as was seen with breast cancer, it seemed like you still could kind of figure out what the absolute benefit was by utilizing the score, you know, just by applying a relative risk reduction, you know, across the board so that, you know, maybe you could distinguish a patient who'd benefit from chemo by 3% as opposed to maybe 8% absolutely. But yet nobody seemed to buy into that.
I think that's the absolute crux of how these data can be applied and how the algorithm can be applied. I think you hit the nail on the head. That just because the hazard ratio is the same relative to chemotherapy, if you have a patient that has a low likelihood of recurrence, the absolute benefit is going to be far smaller than an individual who has a high risk of recurrence. And we see this both in the data from the validation quasar trial, but what is particularly noteworthy is that we see it in NSABP protocol C07, where we put almost 1,000 patients, or half the cohort that we have extracted RNA on so that we could leave the other half for treatment score validation. And you see that 40% fall into a low-risk category, and about 30% falls into a high-risk category. And that in the low-risk category, although the hazard ratio for oxaliplatin, and I want to make it clear, oxaliplatin is a very effective drug in the adjuvant setting, but if you have a hazard ratio of 0.8 clear across the board, that the good risk cohort, which is about 40% of the C07 patients, get a very small benefit from the use of oxaliplatin, even though the hazard ratio is the same. And looking at actual numbers based on risk category that we've generated and is in the manuscript, that I think we come out with some surprises that, for example, in stage 3AB, the FU alone has a 19% risk of recurrence compared to the FLOX or the oxaliplatin arm, which has a 17% five-year risk of recurrence. So are you going to treat that cohort for the delta of 2%? And now we're talking about five-year risk of recurrence that C07 is based on, the C07 analysis is based on, rather than 3 years that was utilized with the quasar and what the validation was from the quasar study. So I think that this provides additional objective data that in multivariate analysis is independent of nodes, is independent of T stage, is independent of grade, of tumor grade, is independent of the number of nodes examined to determine whether one ought to tailor the therapy, and in particular, whether one should or should not utilize oxaliplatin in that setting.
You might remember that a few years ago, our CME group did some surveys of people who'd had adjuvant chemotherapy for colon cancer, and we actually patterned it after the, you know, those Australian, I think, studies done in breast cancer a long time ago. And, you know, we found a spectrum of what patients would do in order to avoid recurrence. Just in breast cancer, I think 30% of the people would go through chemo again for 1% reduction in risk of recurrence. And yet, you know, another group, I think it was 20%, would not take it for a 12% absolute benefit. So to me, it kind of doesn't tell you exactly what to do, but maybe provides more information that the patient can utilize in trying to figure out whether it's worth taking oxaliplatin.
Precisely. Precisely. And I think that at least one now has some objective data to determine what the absolute benefit is going to be rather than go into speculative arguments.
One of the things I think is interesting also, and again, we had a poster at the recent ASCO GI symposium where we looked at 400 cases that were treated both by investigators and general oncologists. And we saw a lot of oxaliplatin use. And the two areas that I was most surprised at is we saw a lot in stage two, and we saw a lot in stage three older people, you know, 75 and older. And both of those things kind of surprised me. Did they surprise you?
Well, they surprised me in the generalities. I think using oxaliplatin in stage two just as a standard, I think can be challenged. And I think they can be challenged in particular based on the data from Quasar and C07. If the patient falls into the 25% or so that's high risk, that has a recurrence score of between 41 and 70 or 41 and greater, that subset overlaps with T4s in stage two. It also overlaps with 1-3 node positive patients. And what we have shown in NSABP protocol C07 is that the addition of oxaliplatin for high risk stage twos does seem to be efficacious. So it's not a matter of simply stage twos versus stage threes, it's a matter of risk. That those individuals who are at high risk get a better benefit from oxaliplatin, whether they're stage twos or stage threes.
You know, I thought the idea of looking at the addition of oxali was really, you know, clever clinically. Because, you know, when you think about it, again, thinking about breast cancer, when breast cancer, you're talking about, you know, TC or an anthracycline as the baseline kind of treatment that they're going to get if they're going to get adjuvant chemo. But in colon cancer, you have fluoropyrimidines, you know, particularly capecitabine, which, you know, a lot of people seem to badmouth, but I mean, it seems like it, you know, would be a lot easier, certainly, than the breast IV regimens. But it seems like where the quality of life thing comes in is really that jump to oxali in terms of peripheral neuropathy.
So, you know, oxali is an effective drug. On the other hand, just as you state, it's associated with neurotoxicity. And although if you look at grade 3 neurotoxicity at 12 months, that's a fraction of a percent residuum. But on the other hand, if you look at overall long-lasting neurotoxicity, that's not trivial. And, you know, 15% or 20% of the patients have some residual neurotoxicity. So certainly if you can avoid that, and I think those patients who are aware of that end up getting into discussions based on neurotoxicity and risk and benefit. And I think this algorithm is going to provide objective evidence as to whether one ought or ought not utilize oxaliplatin, both in stage twos and the stage three settings.
I'm kind of curious if a patient were to ask you, okay, we're talking about taking oxaliplatin here in the adjuvant setting, just taking into account all the data that you've seen, your clinical experiences, et cetera, what's the chance that 2-3 years from now, I'm going to have some kind of a peripheral neuropathy problem that I'm not going to be happy about?
Well, again, that's an individual thing. And of course, if you look at activities of daily living, I mean, those are relatively of small proportion at that time. But having some kind of residuum of persistent, you know, grade 1 or grade 2 is not insignificant. And I would say that that's going to be in the range of 15%.
That's almost exactly what the docs in this survey predicted. And incidentally, another thing about this survey that I thought was really interesting was that we gave them different scenarios and said, okay, what would you tell a patient their risk of relapses with and without chemo, with and without oxali, et cetera, you know, sort of a typical kind of numerology. And one of the things that was interesting was that the numbers that they gave were very accurate, you know, similar to what you see in Adjuvant Online. But the numbers given by the investigators, the 27 investigators, was almost exactly the same as the number given by the 75 docs in practice, making me think that sort of the numeracy of adjuvant therapy has now come into colon cancer. I'm not sure it's in lung, but I think it's in colon now.
Which I think would be a good thing. And I think fine-tuning that risk, I think, is one of the advantages of applying the algorithm defined in the Oncotype DX to stage threes as a case in point and oxaliplatin.
I want to ask you what the next step is in this research, but one other thing I just want to get your thoughts on from the survey that I was mentioning. We asked these docs, theoretically, what absolute benefit, and we used risk of recurrence, in general, would you want to see in order to justify giving oxaliplatin to a patient? And interestingly, it was around 5%. It was pretty consistent, around 5%. I'm curious what you think about that. In what situations, for example, in stage 2 disease, can you pull out an absolute benefit of 5%, particularly without something like the 12-gene recurrence score?
Well, for stage twos, I think you will see a 5% for the T4 lesions. If they're MMR deficient, they're at extremely good risk, and I think we can eliminate them because their risk is under 5% at 3 years. And the proficient MMRs have a range between 9% and 28%. Of risk. So what's the delta with, let's say, leucovorin-modulated 5-FU? And there we saw overall that there was about a 3-4% advantage in the QUASAR trial, which is one of the few examples of a pure stage 2 cohort, When we look at the NSABP C07, where they were all treated, we see a range of recurrence at 5 years of 23% for a stage 2 population that's in the high risk. Overall, it's about 17%. In the low risk, it's about 7%. And the incremental benefit of adding oxaliplatin to 5-FU seems to be far more marked as far as the numeric difference, the absolute difference, in the high recurrence score cohort.
So from a practical point of view, before we talk about where this is heading right now today, this 12-gene score is available. For that matter, there are other assays, the Colaprint is available. Do you see a role for these outside of protocol setting, and in what kind of situation?
Yeah, I do see a role for them, which leads to another question. Why hasn't it been embraced with greater vigor? You know, the Oncotype is now used in over 60% of women who are node negative, ER positive in this country. And with its use, we see an absolute drop in the number of patients receiving adjuvant chemotherapy. On the other hand, in colon, we have a debate. And I think you were very instrumental in showing us the different trigger points to treat for a medical oncologist in adjuvant colon compared to breast. I think there's a different makeup and a different philosophy relative to the use of adjuvant chemotherapy and the delta that's necessary to trigger the use of adjuvant therapy. By the same token, I think we see the same debate and the same reluctance apply to embracing an objective, validated, and now confirmed again in C07 assay that provides prognostic information, which I think is incontrovertible and is useful when discussing options with patients who are informed.
You know, kind of like you have the argument in breast cancer in terms of node positive use of something like the 21 gene recurrence score. You know, a lot of people use it with one or two nodes, but it get kind of maybe reluctant to use it with multiple nodes. What about in colon cancer? Do you see its potential use in stage 3 disease or more in, you know, just with a couple of positive nodes?
Yes, I do. Even though the relative risk is the same across the entire continuous variable for the addition, for example, of oxaliplatin, the absolute benefit varies, I think, quite dramatically from low risk to high risk. So if a patient was reluctant to have oxaliplatin and they fell into the high risk, I would be pretty forceful in trying to convince that individual to have oxaliplatin as part of the regimen. On the other hand, if they fell into the low risk, where the absolute benefit, even though the hazard ratio is still the same, is going to be much smaller, one can justify, as far as I'm concerned, based on the data from the Oncotype in C07, not utilizing oxaliplatin.
You know, regarding your comment about the fact that it hasn't been picked up the way it did in breast cancer, another thing we saw in the survey, though I can't be 100% sure, I'd like to see more data, was it seemed like there was more use of the 12-gene recurrence score in colon cancer in the community oncologists than in the investigators. And I kind of wonder whether they were sort of used to the concept coming out of breast.
I don't have very good insight as to the reason it has not been embraced by one medical oncology cohort and has been embraced in a lukewarm fashion by another. I do hope that the data from C07 are going to be instrumental in at least drawing attention to the fact that we do have a validated and confirmed algorithm that's associated with outcome in a definitive and in an unequivocal fashion. Getting back to the other question that you asked me, and that is the use of oxaliplatin in patients over 70 that I think you alluded to earlier. And I think what both the meta-analysis from Dan Sargent, the ACCORD, of which both C07 and Mosaic were a part of, as well as in C07, that the addition of oxaliplatin seems to become attenuated in patients over 70. And I think one has to be circumspect, I mean, regardless of the oncotype, in using oxaliplatin in patients who are over 70 years of age. Now, of course, that's a continuous variable as well. So I think one has to, you know, not use 70 as an absolute cutoff because biology doesn't work that way. On the other hand, when one looks at the data as a whole and we use a binary cutoff of age 70, that there seems to be very little additional incremental benefit in patients over 70 years of age from the addition of oxali.
Any hypothesis about why?
There are hypotheses. I mean, are they really, you know, getting oxali? Do they have more toxicity with oxali? Are they less willing to get the cumulative dose? Although you could make arguments that, you know, cumulative dose probably is not the be-all and the end-all. As you know, CO7 used 3/4 of the cumulative dose that the Mosaic did and got the identical 6% incremental benefit. We could not find an answer in NSABP CO7, although we just didn't have the power to really look at patients who are over 70 years of age. And even I think the combined analysis from NSABP and Mosaic probably doesn't have the scope and the data set to be able to come out with any intelligent insights on that.
Of course, the Mosaic trial is the other major phase 3 oxali adjuvant trial. And I've heard rumors that maybe this 12-gene recurrence score is going to be looked at. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Also, there is a treatment score being developed, which looks promising, with different genes, which is predictive of oxali, rather than simply prognostic of the overall cohort. Because the current 12-gene algorithm is not predictive, it's prognostic. It's not predictive of oxali benefit. It's simply prognostic, with a hazard ratio for benefit being the same across all groups and for the whole spectrum of the continuous variable. So there is a treatment score that's being developed that could be validated in both NSABP CO7 as well as the Mosaic.
Interesting.
Using different genes. Because, you know, we tried to develop a treatment score for validation in the QUASAR, and it was not validated in the QUASAR. So everyone's gone back to the drawing board, a different algorithm with different genes. The original treatment score algorithm tested in the QUASAR trial, which was not predictive of chemotherapy benefit, those genes proved to be prognostic rather than predictive. So an entirely different algorithm has been developed for treatment score associated with oxaliplatin benefit, which is showing promise.
So I want to ask you about another study that I've always found really interesting, the C10 trial, looking at patients who present with a primary tumor and metastatic disease, with the primary being asymptomatic. Can you talk a little bit about the background to that study, what was seen, and what you think it means?
Well, you know, the teaching had always been that even in a patient who had disease outside the colon, that one should resect the primary because of risk of perforation, risk of bleeding, risk of obstruction. And we argued that the use of modern adjuvant therapy with a lesion in situ was an alternative approach that could spare the patient an operation. And the endpoints were pre-specified a priori in C10, and we found that the risks of the putative complications that led to resection of the primary lesion were such that one could make a strong justification to simply treat the metastatic disease and not resect the primary lesion, saving the patient a significant operative intervention.
I think that I've seen that strategy being incorporated into clinical practice where, you know, systemic therapy is used first if the primary is asymptomatic. A lot of times the primary itself will respond. But I have heard people question that strategy actually based on your findings, because you did find, you know, not inconsequential number of patients who ended up having emergent surgery with not necessarily the same kind of outcome they might have had with elective surgery. I think it was maybe 15% of your patients. What about that concern?
Well, I think if one has objective data, I think that it's perfectly justified for individuals to review that data and, armed with that data, make informed decisions with their patients as to whether the risk outweighs the benefits. But by the same token, one can look at the same data and make the argument that one ought not resect, which I think is the preponderant conclusion, as opposed to the smaller proportion of individuals who are just as ethically motivated and concerned about their patient outcome, who look at the same data and still believe that resection is justified, which I think is a perfectly understandable and reasonable thing to do.